Blog Talk.
Welcome to another great episode we have here of Suspense Radio on this Saturday, March the 10th, 2012. I'm your host, John Robb. Today we have an action-packed hour-and-a-half show with you. Three authors, Catherine Arnold, Spencer Sedell, and Elliot Patson will wrap it up in the 11 o'clock hour. So we have a lot of things to go over, a lot of things to talk about. We got a couple audiobook clips you're going to hear today, and a lot of other exciting stuff we're going to try to get into. So sit back, relax, and enjoy, because 90 minutes of Suspense Radio begins right now. So again, everybody, we want to welcome you back here to the show, and it's a great Saturday morning, a lot of things happening, a lot of great guests we got coming on here today, and we're going to start it right off with our first guest, Catherine Arnold, who wrote her first book here, The Resurrection of Hannah, which is the first book in a series that she is writing called the Samantha Clark series. So we're going to meet both of them, but we're going to talk with Catherine, and she's going to channel Samantha. So Catherine, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
Hi, John. Thanks so much for having me on your show. I'm really excited.
Fabulous. So The Resurrection of Hannah, like I said, is the first in a series that you decided to write with Samantha Clark as your main character. So tell everybody a little bit about the novel and your character, Samantha, so they can get a little more familiar with what you wrote.
Okay. Well, The Resurrection of Hannah, it came out about 10 months ago. And so, you know, I'm a psychotherapist and a clinical certified hypnotherapist. Excuse me. And I have a practice locally in Tarpon Springs, Florida. And I work in a hospital. So that's the field I'm in for about 25 years. My main character, Samantha Clark, also is a psychotherapist and a hypnotherapist. Uh-huh. Surprise, surprise. So I ended up having a series of very powerful dreams several years ago. And the book was actually born out of those dreams. So it was inspired by true events. And it takes place in St. Petersburg, Florida, where I lived for 20 years. And also New England in Gloucester, Massachusetts, near Boston. So,
okay.
It's present day and about 250 years ago. So the main character starts having these really powerful dreams that start really affecting her, not feeling well, things like that. these clues in the dream, she decides to check out to see if they're real, and they turn out to have some real facts. So she goes to New England and with her father embarks on this adventure, kind of a journey, and she solves a murder mystery, which is to free herself in present day.
Now, just so people know, because what exactly, I mean, just to get a little more background of yourself and that, and your character too, a psychotherapist and then a hypnotist kind, how, you got to explain a little bit of dynamic on that, because I don't want to get hypnotized on the radio by anything that you might be doing. So I want to kind of know the signs. So what exactly, you know, kind of a little in-depth of like an everyday experience that this profession would have, so people can kind of understand when they're reading about Samantha, it makes it so they can kind of relate, like, with her, you know, with her situation and the things that she's going through.
Well, she has her own practice, just like I have my own practice. And you get so many different types of people. Now, in my first novel, I'm actually writing my third novel. In my first novel, she's a mental health therapist, a psychotherapist. She becomes hypnotized to find out about a past life through a friend. We used to do this in a metaphysical group that I actually started with a group of friends for about 18 months, and that became part of the book. So she becomes disenchanted with everyday life and having a private practice, counseling people that are pretty well healed, not any major mental health issues, just kind of anxiety and depression, things like that. The hypnosis that I use in my real practice, and that will also be in the first book and the third book more so, you use counseling combined with the clinical hypnotherapy to uncover blocks and really memories that are kept on a cell level. You want to break the psychological kind of ties to a traumatic event and the emotional connection to it, so a person can get better and heal. So that's kind of what I use in my book.
Fascinating.
I won't hypnotize you, don't worry. It's not like the hypnosis that you see, like the stage hypnosis where people get up and...
If I start cackling like a chicken, I'm going to know
why.
Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. Okay. No.
So then when you said that, you know, it's inspired by real, you know, true life events, these are things that you've encountered during your practice that you were able to kind of relay that. Was that, I guess... You know, and I don't ask you to, what's your inspiration with it, but was that kind of the moment that you decided, you know, through your practice that you said, you know what, this has to be down in some kind of a book, either because people just won't believe it, or just simply because it's just so fascinating, I think people would just love to read about it.
Okay, so let me explain. Now, like I said, my first book, The Resurrection of Hannah, has been out for a while. I'm going to be having my second book, The Fear of Things to Come, out in about 3 months.
Okay.
The first book was inspired by true events, not really from what happened in counseling people, but what happened with myself through some really powerful dreams that were so intense and actually weird. I mean, I'm like, what is this about? But I had a series of them, and they were like recurring, and I'm like, okay, this must mean something. You know, what's going on here? And being a mental health therapist and everything, I'm going to analyze that kind of stuff.
Right.
And what I did is I spinned it into a novel. But I would say, about 50% of my book is actually really happened to me. For example, the metaphysical group and my friends in there, we really did meet. We were a bunch of counselors that were just interested in kind of alternative medicines and fun stuff, you know. And so that all those things are in my book. I used to live in a house that was like, I think it's about 300 years old now, in Gloucester, that had secret passageways and doorways and hidden rooms.
Oh, wow.
And I used that in my book, that I go back there to discover supposedly a past life that I had, you know, and that's the part I made into a novel, because it was fun.
Right, and, you know, and that's something that I think a lot of authors, because, you know, Resurrection of Hannah, and I want to remind everybody, we're speaking here with Catherine Arnold, and her website is CatherineArnold.com, and that's K-A-T-H-R-Y-N-E, Arnold.com, and the book is Resurrection of Hannah, first book in the Samantha Clark series, and, you know, like Catherine just said, that she's working on her next one, The Fear of Things to Come, which you can read a link to the first chapter on our website, too.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're sitting down, and, you know, a lot of authors don't realize that you should write about what you know first before you try to go and explore the unknown by doing the research and going out and whatnot, which is, you know, which is why when you read your book, the Resurrection of Hannah, you can understand that it's a topic that you understand to the fullest, which gives it the realism part of the book instead of somebody just faking it. And that's the great thing of why, you know, we were intrigued to be able to speak with you, because, you know, there's a lot of authors out there that don't do that, and they need to understand that they need to write about what they know. And that's something that when you talk about with Samantha Clark and the realism, you know, how real, I guess, is she from the real life into the book life, that, you know, so people can kind of understand. Because a lot of people read characters now instead of instead of topics. That's the big thing, I think. A lot of people are character-driven instead of, you know, plot.
Yeah, and I think my books are both. I try to make it really strong in both ways. So were you asking me, like, how much of basically
you is kind of in Samantha of channeling those kinds of things? Yeah.
It's basically me about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, when I was a little bit younger. And I've been in the mental health and social services field for, like I said, quite a while. I have had incredible experiences, some things that you can't even – people wouldn't believe it if you even put it in a book. Some things I've heard from people that were horrifying, and I'm like, oh, it shocked even me, and that's kind of hard to do. So, like in my second book – it is more of a thriller, suspense, mystery, because I took some of those things and stories and true events and whatever that I gleaned from all these different people I worked with and made more of those characters in the second book. It's more like a page-turner. I'm getting really good buzz on my second book from different people that have read it. So I wanted to be able to see if I could be like the bad, the antagonist, a really bad character, basically. So it balances out that evil kind of character, balances out Samantha Clark, which is really me, in the book. And it was really fun to go back and forth, and it was a challenge to see if I could do it. I think I did pretty well in that. So.
And so when your fans email or, you know, you meet them out and they talk about it, what's kind of the one thing that you tend to see them asking a lot of that kind of piques their, you know, curiosity with the first book, The Resurrection of Hannah, that you wrote?
The first book, because they're interested in the metaphysical aspect. It's a very particular genre, as you know.
It is.
Metaphysical, supernatural. So they kind of want to know about that. Like, what does that mean? How does that work in your book? And then they really want to know because under the title, The Resurrection of Hannah, I have a novel inspired by true events. They want to know, like, what's true? Because some of the stuff is kind of unbelievable in a sense that it's out of the normal and that they haven't experienced it. I find people really fascinated about that. And they, you know, they really want to know, a lot of people that have read it, they want to know what part is you or that you experienced and what part, you know, was just the novel. And the way I think I wrote it, it's kind of hard to tell in a way, which is what I wanted to do. You know, so yeah, I have a lot of people that are very curious about the whole metaphysical, just different, you know, psychological components of the book.
So the book was kind of, like you said, you kind of got this, you were having some dreams, you decided that this needed to be going on. So then, did you decide that you were going to go ahead and create Samantha Clark around everything that you had, or were you saying, okay, let's get the whole storyline down, and then you're going to kind of create the character to kind of fit within, you know, the fabric of the story?
Because Samantha Clark is essentially myself, younger, I was writing it from the viewpoint of myself.
Okay.
And a lot of people wanted me to write a nonfiction book, like a self-help, psychology, regular nonfiction book. And I didn't want to do that because my whole life...
Those are boring.
Yeah, my whole life has to do with helping people,
yeah,
and self-help, and I love it. However, I wanted to do something that was totally challenging, completely different, and I wanted to do it for almost therapeutic, you know, and fun, and those kind of things was important to me. So when I write, I don't, like, map out everything. I have it very loose, if anything. I literally sat down, which is when the very first time I even wrote. I literally sat down and kind of just let it come out, and it came out really easily, and I followed it. So I follow my characters, if that makes sense. I follow the plot line, and then as you're doing it, all of a sudden you have these ideas and how things can intertwine, and then sometimes you realize, like, that's not going to really work. So then you have to kind of pull back and, you know, think of another way of saying something or whatever. But for me, I do follow whatever is coming out of me creatively, just like naturally.
So, we're, again, we're speaking with Catherine Arnold at her website of CatherineArnold.com, and that's Catherine, K-A-T-H-R-Y-N-E, Arnold.com. The first book, The Resurrection of Hannah, and now the second one coming out in a couple months, The Fear of Things to Come, all in the Samantha Clark series. And so what's the biggest distinction that you can tell people from the first book now going on to the second book? How has Samantha kind of evolved herself going forward? How has your writing evolved yourself? You know, what's the major change that fans are going to notice from the first into the second, not only with you but with your character?
The genre and type of the book, like I said, is different. The first one is more character-driven, and it's a slower read. It's more inspirational, motivational, like an adventure mystery. The second book is kind of, the chapters are more clipped. It's like a page-turner. The book's longer. It's a lot darker. The second book was darker, and it is more of a suspense thriller. So people are going to notice that. It's more like commercial from what I've been hearing from everybody, because everybody likes mystery and suspense and thrillers. The character, Samantha Clark, and several of her friends are the core characters in the first book. Several of them go on to the second book, and their characters are even more developed in the second book. So she grows a whole lot, because in the first book she has this fabulous, like, mystery adventure journey that she discovers parts of herself that she didn't know existed, and her goal was to have a wellness retreat, like health center, in the woods of Florida, which that used to be one of my real goals that I wasn't able to pull off financially. We have, we have traditional medicine combined with, like acupuncture and meditation and those kind of things.
Right.
So that was her dream, and through the whole mystery unfolding and discovering things about herself in the first book, she went ahead and realized that dream. So she's out in the woods in Florida living her dream, having all kinds of neat programs going on for people, and that's where it takes off for the second book. And that is, like I said, a suspense murder. I don't know how much you'd want me to go into that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it takes off there, and, of course, in the woods and it
right.
ends up being terrorized and all these things happen. So it's that whole woodsy thing that people like where you have to really try to survive psychologically,
authors,
you know.
Yeah, and a lot of authors that you know I speak to, they're always some kind of surprise that kind of came out of their book that they had no idea that this was going to happen. And it typically happens with like a secondary character that they just started writing to just fill the time. And then all of a sudden they realize, you know, that this character is a lot of fun and it's something that they need to explore more just because of how the story cards flow and you know, they just kind of fit in there. And then all of a sudden they find themselves liking the secondary character more than the main one. Did you kind of have that same kind of feeling? Is there a secondary character that's in, you know, your book that you didn't think would be as popular to yourself as it ended up being?
I would probably say that it is, his name is Donnie in the book, and he ends up being, I guess it's the antagonist.
Okay.
And I didn't know that I would have him in there so much. And as the storyline progresses, it ends up almost being a duel between myself and this person. And I had a blast. I had no idea that I would get into this character so much because I didn't know if I could be, like, evil and just be so completely different than Samantha. And in its dialogue, you know, just approach to life, just everything. And that was, the contrast is like, was wonderful to go back and forth between those two characters. And I did draw from the people I had met through the different positions I had, some of very unusual characters in real life that I did kind of use sort of as the base for this character, but I just bumped it up a few notches. You know, so that, yes, I had, it was great being that character and seeing if I could pull it off and develop it through like almost 400 pages. And, so to answer that question,
I think I almost
enjoyed that more.
Right. And you know, it almost kind of happens to where, and those are the emails you start getting from fans. You start realizing it's like, they're starting to like, you know, that character a lot more. To where you almost start going, and your brain starts turning and it starts thinking, it's like, well, I wonder if this person can kind of do their own thing in another book or something like that. And, you know, authors kind of have, you know, those, I guess, I don't know if they're epiphanies or whatnot.
I was just going to say that, epiphany.
So it's just one of those things. And seeing as how, you know, you're getting in and you're kind of new to the whole process, you know, which is, it's just like, you know, wow, these kinds of things have happened, and it's just fun to kind of see, and it's, you know, just trying to kind of see yourself, you know, how they progress that way. So
yes, and like the second book hasn't come out yet, so
right.
Just from the people that I know personally, and I've had my editor and a publicist that I had, I no longer have her right now. I wanted to do it more on my own, but her and other people, they were totally into it. They just loved that character I was able to develop. They're like, it was like creepy, and I mean all the kind of feelings I wanted to elicit. But a lot of people want to know, like, when's your next book coming out? Because they want to know, what does Samantha do next? What happens next? What she's going to do? What's the next mystery that's going to happen? So that's, to me, that it makes you feel really good, because when you write and you start writing, you don't know. Everybody starts from somewhere or from nowhere. They don't know what they're doing. No matter who it is, you know. And you don't know, are people going to like what I'm writing? Is it good enough? And, you know, you have all those, I think all writers
have felt
that.
Yeah, you have all those questions that kind of go through your head and your mind, and you start, you never want to question yourself, but, you know, I can always understand. Well, I'll tell you what, Catherine, I want to thank you so much for coming on. We've run out of time. I mean, we've just been flying through, and it's been fascinating. So, but I want to thank you again so much for coming on, and I want to remind everybody that the book is Resurrection of Hannah, and then the next one, which is coming out very soon, The Fear of Things to Come. So you have time to read the first one to get into the second one to find out all you can about Samantha Clark and inside the head of Catherine Arnold. And if you get hypnotized, it's not my fault. That's your disclaimer. So, Catherine, again, thank you again so much for coming on, and you have a great day.
Thank you so much, John. I really enjoyed myself. You're a wonderful host, by the way.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
You're great. So you have
all
a great
right.
weekend.
You too. And we will talk with you later. And thanks again
okay.
so much for coming on. All right.
Okay, take
bye-bye.
Care. Bye-bye.
So again, everybody, that was our author, Catherine Arnold. CatherineArnold.com is her website, Catherine, R-Y-N-E. The book is Resurrection of Hannah. You can find a lot of information about her by going to her website and checking her out. And it's a different subject line than, you know, you might be used to, which is something that we always try to do here for you, is to give you everything that we possibly can. Right now, we're going to do something a little different real quick. And we mentioned this last week, is we are going to play audio clips of your books on the air if you send them to us, and they're good. And this is the first one that we're going to do right now. We're going to have another one later. But author L.J. Sellers has written many different books. She has entrepreneur extraordinaire, e-booking herself and this and that. She is definitely somebody that if you have not read, I don't know what the hell you're waiting for. So we have a clip of her book here. It's a couple minutes, called The Sex Club. You can find a lot about LJ by going to ljsellers.com and all the stuff that she has to offer, and Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and check her out. So right now we want to introduce you to LJ Sellers and The Sex Club.
The computer came up with Paul Davenport, Jesse's father. Jackson had met the man once, 2 years ago, at a soccer game. He had moved to Seattle. Even so, with a cell phone, Paul Davenport could be calling Jesse from anywhere. Schakowsky was already tracking him down, and a father's calls to his daughter didn't trigger Jackson's suspicion. He kept moving down the list. A local number with only 7 connections belonged to George Miller, the first name in the group that sparked Jackson's interest. A classmate? A boyfriend? He ran him through a second database. Miller lived on Friendly Street, worked for the county as a building inspector, and had 3 kids. One was a 14-year-old boy named Greg Miller, who attended Kincaid Middle School. The boy had been picked up for shoplifting in a convenience store when he was 12. As Jackson made a note to interview Greg Miller, he realized that the kid was also one of the Bible study group. He wondered if Evans had interviewed him yet. Jackson punched in the last number he'd circled, which also had a 513 cell phone prefix. A moment later, a familiar name came up. Miles R. Fieldstone. The mayor again? A tingle went up Jackson's spine. He quickly scanned for the address associated with the number 27575 Blanton Heights. Yep, that was the mayor. Jackson glanced back at the printout. The calls were evenly split both ways, 4 incoming, 3 outgoing. Now the hairs on the back of his neck were standing at attention. Why would the head of the city chat on the phone with a 13-year-old girl 7 times in 30 days? To arrange get-togethers at the apartment he rented near her school, right next to where her body was found. A surge of adrenaline rushed through his torso, and Jackson bolted out of his chair. Now he had a suspect with a direct link to the victim. But that charged feeling, like a bloodhound that has picked up the fox's scent, was overshadowed by a more sobering thought. Fieldstone was the mayor. He played golf with the chief of police. This would not go down easy.
Glamour, celebrity, and murder. Whether you're looking for mystery or suspense, you'll find it all at Thriller Fast. Open to readers, aspiring writers, and published authors. Learn craft, meet top thriller writers, and enjoy New York City July 11th through the 14th. Jack Higgins, R.L. Stine, Lee Child, Karen Slaughter, Catherine Coulter, Richard North Patterson, John Sanford, and Rule, and more. Join them this summer. Find out more at www.thrillerfest.com.
Pinned to my wall,
everybody. Hopefully you enjoyed that LJ Sellers, the Sex Club, and, of course, our commercial for Thriller Fest to let everybody know that that's what they need to do coming up in the summer. We are going to head right on here to our next guest, the author of Dead of Winter. Spencer Sadow is our guest right now. So, Spencer, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing today?
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm doing very well.
Wonderful. So, like I said, the book, Dead of Winter, fabulous reviews. You know, Publishers Weekly gave you a good one. You got Michael Palmer on there. You know, tell us a little bit about the book, a little bit behind the scenes action of everything, and, you know, kind of your thought process of going through it.
Well, it's actually kind of an interesting story.
Years
ago,
back... interesting. Love
yeah, of
interesting.
Course, right? Yeah. Back in the 50s, my mother's family used to vacation out on a campsite in Michigan. And one summer, that unfortunately, one of the teenagers in their group drowned. And my
Ooh.
Mother always suspected that there had been some foul play because there was kind of a bad seed kid that they hung around with.
Mm-hmm.
And that story had been kind of like a legend in our family for all those decades. And then my grandmother had a touch of dementia and was in a nursing home and told my mom that, in fact, it was true, that it might not have been an accident, and, in fact, that some of the grown-ups had been taking part in kind of helping to cover up to keep the kid from getting arrested. Now,
wow.
All of that is you know... It's still, I don't know if it's entirely true, but that was sort of the seed for the book. It had been for a long time. My mother and I had many conversations about this over the years. And so when my grandmother let that little tidbit slip, my mom, you know, immediately called me up and said, "You won't believe this, blah, blah, blah." And so that's that little kernel of a story sort of, you know, grew into what became the book.
So... when you find out something like that, and I don't know if, you know, how far back you can go police-wise or anything else like that to kind of, you know, reopen the case or have someone
yeah.
look at it, did those kinds of things happen? And then, I mean, is that something that you guys, you know, thought maybe you should do? Or I mean, what the hell do you do when you hear something? I mean, I'm just sitting
no,
here
I know.
Wondering, like, Jesus.
Yeah, no, it's a thing. It's about the story is about 50 years old, and unfortunately, my mother and her brother, my uncle, were only peripherally involved in this. This was a group of kids that, you know, they didn't hang around with. So it was just one of those family stories. And being that it's 50 years old, you know, we don't, you know, there's really, I don't think there's much
right.
that can be done, if anything.
So then. Did you take a lot of information, I guess, to write the book from your grandmother and your mother and their experiences and their theories that they had, and then you kind of rolled it all into a fictional setting? Was that kind of your thought process going forward?
Yeah, the first thing I did was change the setting because I don't know anything about Michigan. My mother moved away from Michigan
right.
when she was 18. She always wanted to live in New York, so I grew up in the New York area and had been traveling to Maine, and I lived there for a time, and so I immediately said, "Oh, perfect, rural Maine." And then I took my family had kind of a weird dynamic because we had a grandfather who was a little bit overbearing and some you might say cruel, and so I took some of the characters from our family and sort of stuffed that old 50-year-old story into, you know. Laid those characters on top of it, if you will. And it just sort of came, the story just came out naturally from the characters after I had done that.
And is there kind of one, I guess, scene in the book or even maybe one sentence that kind of captures the essence of maybe not just your writing, but the whole, you know, kind of the whole idea of the book into like one snapshot right there?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that scene occurs later in the book because one of the things that I tend to do with my characters, which I like to do, is I'm intrigued by people who have kept secrets for a long time
mm-hmm.
and who maybe lie to others and themselves about who they really are, if you know what I mean.
Right.
And the main character in Dead of Winter, Alice Winter, is one of those people. She had some horrible things happen to her, you know, in her childhood, and she sort of spent the rest of her life pretending to be something that she really wasn't. And there's one scene where, which I can't really describe because it'll give away too much, but there's one scene towards the end where she's racing off to find someone and has kind of an epiphany, you know, at that moment and says, oh my God, you know, this is what I am. I have to face that. And I think that's that kind of sums up what the book is about.
And now, just from, you know, just from the actual emotional part of this was in your family and kind of seeing how, I guess, you know, kind of how it affected your family, how difficult was it for you to write, and was it difficult for your family to end up reading to kind of rehash those events from 50 years ago?
Well, I actually asked my mother, well, first of all, I wrote the first draft because I figured that, you know, that's not going to hurt anybody. And certainly from my point of view, it wasn't difficult because I'm not emotionally, you know, attached to many of these characters and even members of my own family who I don't see very often.
Mm-hmm.
Once I thought, well, this could be a real book, I asked my mother, like, are you okay with this? Because this is, you know, this guy is kind of like you, or your brother, this Alice is a little bit like you, you know, blah, blah, blah. And she said, yeah, go for it, fine. And even to the point, I had an uncle who was alcoholic, and one of the characters is based on him, and I said, even him? And because he had passed away. And
right.
She said, just do what you got to do. And I didn't seek approval from the extended family because I sort of just said, look, this is loosely based on my family. There's nothing specific in there where if you read it, you'd say, oh, you know, it doesn't tell you anything about me, you know, in
right.
other words. It's very loosely based on these characters. So, but I didn't seek approval from my extended family, but my mother, I made sure she was okay with it.
Yeah, I guess there's nothing worse than maybe writing something and then, you know, hearing about it later and going,
I guess
maybe I've made a mistake. I should have asked somebody.
Yeah, I did not want it because I knew I was going to be doing, you know, if I sold it, I knew I was going to be doing things like this and people would be hearing about it, you know, so I didn't really want somebody to find out something by accident like you just suggested, you know.
Right. And so I want to remind everybody we're speaking here with author Spencer Sedol. And am I saying your last name right? Because I suck at them.
That, you know, it's people mess it up all the time. It's Sedol.
Sedol. So Spencer Sedol. His website is SpencerSedol.com, Seidel. And you'll also notice that when you go on his website, because, you know, you have blogs and you have, you know, your Twitter and everything, but there's also another book that is out called Lovesick.
Yes.
And so I'm trying to understand, was Lovesick, is that your first book you wrote and then Dead of Winter was second?
No, it's the other way around. It's confusing on my website.
Okay.
I switch them up sometimes just so that when people land on the site, they might not have seen the other one, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
Lovesick, so what happened was I sold Dead of Winter, thank God, and the year before it was published, I spent, you know, promoting and social networking and things like that, and sort of riding the high of everyone saying, oh, we really like your book, we can't wait for it to come out, and there's
mm-hmm.
a certain sweet spot there where, you know, there are no bad reviews, there are, you know, most people are saying good things.
Yeah.
So I kind of rode that high of that and finished Lovesick during that period. And
a lot of extra motivation knowing that people were on Dead of Winter, you're riding an adrenaline high going,
exactly.
Yeah. And then, yeah. So you're going to write it down and that's what you got to do.
Yeah. Because I knew that, you know, that I would end up being, cause you know, the book has been reviewed a lot and I knew it, like what people said about it would affect how I wrote and things like that. So I just wanted to, I had this idea and I thought, let me just get this one done. And I finished it and my publisher read it. This was before Dead of Winter even came out. And she said, we love it. You know, can we have this one too? And I said, yeah, sure. And then, so we had it ready to go. And my publisher just said, why don't we just release it as an ebook for now? You know, cause there's no point sitting on it, you know? So we released it, you know, a few months later.
I mean, what kind of high were you riding when, you know, this all of a sudden everything just started, all the dominoes just started falling at once, and I don't know if that's something that you had an idea that maybe it could happen or you were hoping it would happen or you were just like, God, just let me get my first book going on, and all of a sudden, you know, like I said, the dominoes just started falling. you know, what kind of thought process and you know, were you, how long did it take for you for it to, like, all sink in that, holy shit, this is real?
You know, it's funny because I had written two other books before that were not published. They're sort of trunk novels, as Stephen King calls them. And they, you know, they don't work for various reasons. I know how to fix them, whatever. My point is, I spent a long time thinking about, you know, I can't wait to have a published book. But I think the reality of it hit me when it was released, and I thought, wow, now I actually have to sell the stupid thing, which is not easy, you know.
No.
So, but it, you know, so it's been kind of up and down in terms of, you know, the emotions about being published and having these books out there, because I've gotten a lot of great feedback. I've connected with old classmates, and, you know, there's been a lot of great stuff that's happened. But, you know, there's also a lot of pressure because there's a lot of people doing this.
Yeah, that's the one thing that I think is the biggest struggle for authors today is not – I almost have to think that the writing of the book is now the easy part. And I think the harder part is marketing yourself, because that's just not what authors are used to doing. You're used to creating but not selling yourself. Do you agree that that's the biggest struggle that authors today now have?
Absolutely. And I think – yeah. We're writing the book when you don't have any outside stuff going on, writing the book is very easy. As soon as you start to get reviews and as soon as people say, I like the way you did this, I don't like the way you did that, whatever, then those voices get into your writing and you know, it's much harder to write after that happens.
Right.
But I think I heard, I don't know who said it, but they put it very well. Some author said, you know, getting published to begin with is a bit of a lottery win. But then all you do is get into another lottery,
right?
You know, because having a published book doesn't mean anything if it doesn't sell, you know, so.
Well, I always like to tell, you know, new authors that are aspiring and this and that, I always say, look, here's the thing, because I get a lot of emails of people asking me, oh, how do you get published? And then I said, look, I said, here's the question.
Sure.
I said, I'm going to tell you right now. If you ever become published, you know, from a big six or from a place that you're not doing it yourself, and so you have to go through the company and the editors and the whole thing, just remember that when you sell your book and you're going to be published, you've only reached the starting gate.
Exactly.
It's not an end. You have just reached the beginning. So the all the stuff before all that, the writing, that was nothing. You have no idea what you're about to get involved in because, like yourself. You had your whole life to write Lovesick, but then when they want book two, you better get it done in 8 months, and then that's when the pressure starts.
Yes, and even then, you know, especially with a series, you know, Lovesick potentially could be a series, but, you know, you, as an author, you know, you sort of struggle with, well, like, I'm, you know, should I write a second one? What if it doesn't sell? You know, there's so much more to it after you've been published. It's crazy. You're absolutely right.
And that's the dynamic that, you know, you're just getting yourself into now. And you're probably going, you know, because you're on Facebook, you're on Twitter, and you're putting yourself out there. And it's got to be not only, you know, do the reviews, because back, you know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, you would get reviews. And if they were bad, it's like, oh, you know, it's a bad review, whatever. But now people can literally go on your Facebook account and whatnot and really hound you. So it's got to be just, you're really putting yourself out in the masses to be able to be either praised or hated, and it's just so scary to understand. It's like, oh God, I got to check my freaking email now. What am I going to get from this?
Oh
email?
Yeah, no, you know that is exactly right. I call it. It's like walking through a minefield. It's like bombs go off in your email all the time because I had recently there was a Goodreads review that was like, you know, and. Because people read books for different reasons, and they take things from books for different reasons. And so, for example, some people really, really care. If they kind of see what the ending's going to be like, and it is like that, then they say, ah, it's silly, it's predictable. But other people say, I couldn't wait to see if it was going to end like I thought it was going to end.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I think people put, you know, the one thing that we don't do with our magazine is we never write a bad review. We just literally say, I'm sorry, but we cannot review it because our opinion, it's not fair for someone like yourself. And again, I just want to remind everybody, again, we're speaking with author Spencer Siddall, and his website, SpencerSiddall.com, is two books, Dead of Winter and Lovesick. So check all that out. S-E-I-D-E-L is how you spell his last name. But we never put bad reviews because it's our opinion, and I think that there's too many other people out there that write bad reviews just to get noticed.
Yeah.
And I think that that's wrong. I'm never going to kill anybody like that.
I really agree with you with that, because I think it's sort of like, you know, the book for you know, you read a novel, it is what it is. And my thing is, did you have a good time reading it? You know, you might disagree, you might not like certain aspects of it, you might whatever, but if it entertained you and you read it and you thought, this is, you know, okay, you know, I was entertained, it rather than saying, well, I wouldn't have written it this way, or this character shouldn't have done that, or whatever. I think it's kind of silly to write reviews like that, but, you know, I'm just one opinion.
Well, the one thing that I always tell people to review and look into that is say, is it sellable? Is there something aspect in there where people will get excited about?
Yeah.
Because, you know, millions and millions of people love The Lord of the Rings, but millions and millions of people don't.
Oh.
But that doesn't mean that the saga is not just absolutely fascinatingly beautifully written. Just because you didn't enjoy it doesn't mean that it's not fascinating. But if you can see the potential and the sellability, like with your books, then that's what people and reviewers, I think, need to look at more than, you know, oh, I didn't like it. Okay, well, maybe you don't. Maybe you need to go read Pride and Prejudice or something, because that's
exactly
more your speed.
And the, you know, it's funny. I had a blog post about this a while back. Sort of, you know, it's hard to handle people who give you a three-star review, which is sort of like a shrug. Okay, you know. Then I say, my advice to authors is, if you ever get a bad review, even if it's terrible, go to Amazon, pick your favorite book, and go look at the reviews, and I guarantee you there will be a whole slew of one-star reviews.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and it's that shows you there's a certain element to that out there that people, you know, it's just the way it goes.
Yeah, and, you know, and that's something, you know, you're speaking of blogs, and that's something that you do. You go out there and you blog and you talk about things and you're interacting with people and giving your opinions. Do you ever just, I mean, I don't know how often that you blog. I mean, is it just kind of something that comes to you and you decide, hey, I'm just going to go out there and, you know, blog about this and talk about it? You know, like your last one was just posted, you know, on March 6th, you know, heading into the woodshed. How do you decide, you know, I'm going to go out there and, you know, and just start blogging and just start talking, and then you just get pissed off about a subject like that and say, I had enough. I'm just going to go out there and just, I don't care what happens. I'm just going to throw myself out there and just hope.
Yeah, I think that, I try to be, I'm careful. I've been doing this online marketing and things like this for a long, long time, because I used to sell guitar software, and before that I had many different rock guitar websites and things like this.
And don't worry, that's my next question.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to get into that, because I saw that you're a rock guitar player, and my number one favorite genre in the world, without a doubt, is rock guitar. So, okay, so go ahead and finish.
So there you go. Well, I was just going to say, I have inadvertently pissed off a lot of people, not through any fault of my own.
Mm-hmm.
But the internet is, you got to be really careful what you say.
Because once it's written, it's out there.
I remember the one I remember best is I went to see a Frank Zappa tribute band, and they were loud. And I wrote in the forum that I was discussing them in, and I said, you know, it was a great show. They're really talented musicians, but it was just too loud for me. And the bass player read it and went completely insane. Flamed, you know, flamey, whatever. So my point is that in blog posts, I tend not to do things like talk about politics or religion or, you know, these sort of hot-button issues. I tend to try to make them, you know, interesting, maybe a little bit funny, you know, because I don't like to be this loudmouth, opinionated, you know, monologuer out there just, you know, blowing hard. I like to, you know, try to have something interesting to say.
Well, here's something interesting, and I had a question. Because I read your bio looking around, and I said, okay, so Spencer, when he's not writing, enjoys playing loud rock guitar, something you've been doing for 25 years. So my question to this is this. If you had one guy that you could get up on stage and jam with, who would it be?
Eddie Van Halen.
Real Eddie Van Halen.
He's been an idol since I was like 12 years old. I saw them, Van Halen, on the Diver Down Tour, and I think it was 82 or 83, and I couldn't believe it.
Love. And are you going to see him coming back out again?
I might. I got to see about that. I haven't been real. I've been listening to the tunes a little bit, you know, and they're okay. But there's something about the old, you know, 20-year-old Eddie Van Halen that I really like, you know.
I mean, because I'm more along the lines, and I know that this is off base, but anytime I have the opportunity to talk about, you know, this kind of music, because I'm a huge Yngwie fan, Satriani, you know, Vi.
Oh, yeah. Right
up
my alley.
Yeah, I mean, I just went to Nam Jam, and I just saw, you know, Tony McAlpine playing with Bruce Kulick and, you know, on stage with Uli John Roth.
All right.
You know, so when you see things like that, it just kind of enamors you, and see the G3 tour with Yngwie, Vi, and Satriani.
Oh, yeah.
And Billy Sheen's in there playing, and I don't cry too often, but that made me tear up because it was just something I never will see again. I'll never see those three guys on a stage again.
I get you.
And
I
I find it fascinating. And so Eddie Van Halen was, you know, you kind of took me back just a little bit because I always consider him more of a band. And I don't know, it might just be me. He's
guy. Let me tell you this. I spent a lot of years trying to play exactly like Steve Vai. I come from a very technical place with guitar playing, and I went to Berkeley for 2 years, College of Music, and I spent a lot of time trying to sound like Steve Vai, and so the Eddie Van Halen thing really comes, it's like a musical Eddie Van Halen sandwich, because I started with Eddie Van Halen was the reason I started playing guitar. Steve Vai was the reason I kept playing guitar, and the reason that I spent, you know, 6 hours every night in a closet practicing. But then after I got out of that technical thing, then I went back to my roots, and now it's more of a feel issue, you know, for me.
Right.
You know what I mean? So.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because I think the only way to play like Steve Vai is to be abducted by aliens, because I think he was abducted by aliens.
Yeah, he's something else. I mean, you know, I'm a huge Zappa fan as well, and some of the stuff he did.
Well, that's where he started.
Yeah, some of the stuff he did with Zappa was just insane. I mean, the transcriptions and things, he was just crazy good.
Yeah. I mean, so is your love of music, and is that something that you possibly could turn into a mystery kind of novel by taking your love of music and putting the two kind of together and, you know, making it? Because I forget, what was the thing? It was Fort Fairlane, wasn't it? It was Fort Fairlane was the rock and roll detective. Remember the Fort Fairlane?
I've never
seen anything else like it.
Yep, I have. It's funny you should say that. I've been trying to get music into my writing for a long time because it's such a part of who I am. And so I'm currently playing around with an idea for more along the lines of a I don't want to say horror because that's not really the right genre, but, you know, thriller, like with a paranormal element to it. You know, sort of like Stephen King isn't really horror. He's, you know. You know what I mean. So I'm sort of playing around with an idea about a violinist involved in a, you know, sort of put in a horrific situation. I'm kind of working with that, and I have other ideas along those lines, because I'm also a huge fan of reading rock biographies.
Me too.
You know,
absolutely.
I got a whole
Dave Mustaine one.
Oh, I know. Yeah. I just finished Hammer of the Gods, which is the second time I've read it about Led Zeppelin. And, you know, there's a bunch of interesting rock characters that I think could make for interesting mysteries, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And to be able to kind of incorporate them with your characters not only would be fun, but, you know, challenging. But, I mean, that's something, you know, there's more authors out there now like John Connolly and Daniel Palmer. And, you know, they put soundtracks to their books now. And I don't know if that's something that you consider doing.
Yeah, I do. In fact, I have soundtrack. I write to soundtracks, literally. And Lovesick was written almost entirely to the Inception soundtrack by Hans Zimmer. And Dead of Winter was written to Frost Nixon, also by Hans Zimmer, who was my favorite, you know, soundtrack composer. But no, I have been thinking about that because I had thought if I ever go down a road where I'm writing something musical like that, with musical characters and things like that, that I would think about how to incorporate, you know, a soundtrack aspect to it.
Well, I'll tell you what, you were very close in writing, you know, you're very close already to getting that musical aspect in there because, of course, Sabotage's album, Dead Winter Dead. So you're very close. You're almost there on Alan. I don't know if you knew that, but
I did
I'll
not
tell
know
you what,
that.
Yeah, so in Sabotages, of course, you know, Chris Olivia was one of my favorite guitar players before he passed away. A lot of people don't realize that Sabotage is now Trans-Siberian Orchestra, so go back and listen to the roots. So I'll tell you what, Spencer, you know, I could go on forever. We could just sit here and talk, but I want to thank you so much for coming on. It has been very enjoyable to just get the background of everything that, you know, you got going on and looking to see, you know, what you have going on in the future, because you have quite a career ahead of you, I believe.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. It's a great conversation. I don't often get the musical thing in it. You know, that's wonderful. Really great.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, like I said, I'm sitting here in my studio and I'm looking. I have my 300 cassette tapes from my old days. I have my 400 CDs from my new days. And then, of course, I got all my MP3s. So, you know, and they're all guitar-driven kinds of things. Even though
very nice.
Even though I kind of don't play anymore, but, you know.
Very nice.
Yeah. All right, Spencer. Well, you have a nice day, and we will talk with you later. So stay
all
in
right.
touch, and, you know, get us when you have your third book coming out.
Great talking to you.
All right. Again, everybody, that was Spencer Siddall and his latest book, a couple of them, about Lovesick and Dead of Winter. You can go on his website, SpencerSiddall.com. Read a lot about him. Read his blogs and everything else he has going on. So we are coming down to our last segment here with author Elliot Patterson. We're going to get him on the line. Right now we're going to listen to another clip here from Libby Hellman. Her book is A Bitter Veil, but I will say that the book does not come out until April 15th. So if you're listening to this show before April 15th, it's not available. If you're listening after April 15th, go get it. And here you go with Libby and her book, A Bitter Veil.
Summer 1980. Anna was deeply asleep, which was unusual for her. She generally tossed and turned until the desperate hours of the night passed, but tonight she'd succumbed almost immediately. The first knock seemed like part of a dream, and her brain started constructing a story around it. As she swam up to consciousness, there was another knock. The sound left a residual imprint in her ears, and for an instant she tried to figure out its intent. Was it an angry thump? A frightened plea? A perfunctory tap? She checked the clock and grew immediately wary. She threw the covers aside, grabbed her chador, and draped it over her baby doll pajamas. Nuri was not home. After what had happened earlier, she wasn't surprised, but it meant she had to answer the door. Still, she hesitated. Whoever was there would see her sharp features, pale green eyes, and blonde eyebrows. They would know she wasn't Iranian. They might even suspect she was from the decadent West, perhaps the great Satan itself. And if that happened, whatever mission brought them would be tainted with that knowledge. She carefully pushed the curtain aside and looked out. It was summer in Tehran, a hot, arid time that reminded her of the dog days of August in Chicago. She and Nuri lived on an upscale street in Shemrun, with walled-off houses set back from the road. At this hour, the street was quiet and dark, save for a black Mercedes parked by the gate. The engine was off, but its headlamps were still on, and two precise beams of light illuminated tree trunks and overgrown bushes. Three uniformed men, all bearded, crowded the door. One had his hands planted on his hips. The other two stood hunched over, arms folded around machine guns. Somehow they'd been able to break through the gate. Fear pumped through her veins. Revolutionary guards. She had no choice. She had to open the door. If she didn't, they would break in, claiming knowledge of crimes she'd committed against Islam and the Republic. When she reached the first floor, she slipped into a pair of black ballet slippers she kept by the door. If the guards saw her toenail polish, they could report her. She held the chador with one hand and opened the door with the other. One of the men's hands was high in the air as if he was just about to knock again. He stepped back, looking startled. The men appraised her. "Your husband," he said, his voice dripping with scorn. "Do you know where he is?" She shook her head and looked at the floor. Oh, God, were they going to beat her up? "Your husband is dead. His body was found in an alley nearby. He was stabbed." She drew a ragged breath. "That cannot be," she lied. "He was with his friend Hassan tonight. Hassan is a guard," she added, as if that gave her legitimacy. "You murdered your husband. Killed him so you could escape Iran and return to America. Now you will never leave. You will die in Iran, just like your husband."
Glamour, celebrity, and murder. Whether you're looking for mystery or suspense, you'll find it all at Thriller Fest. Open to readers, aspiring writers, and published authors. Learn craft, meet top thriller writers, and enjoy New York City July 11th through the 14th. Jack Higgins, R.L. Stine, Lee Child, Karen Slaughter, Catherine Coulter, Richard North Patterson, John Sanford, Ann Rule, and more. Join them this summer. Find out more at www.thrillerfest.com.
So I want to welcome everyone back here to our last segment we got going on with Suspense Radio. I want to thank, first of all, our first two guests we had on with Catherine Arnold, and we just had Spencer Sadal on talking about their books, Catherine Arnold, The Resurrection of Hannah, and Spencer Sadal, Dead of Winter. So you can find them out by going to Amazon and all those kinds of places and going to their website and reading their blogs and connecting with them on Facebook or whatever you got to do. I also want to thank LJ Sellers for her clip of the Sex Club earlier, and just Libby Hellman with, you just heard her clip of A Bitter Veil. Her book is out April 15th. If you want to get involved and you want to have your book read on the air for a 2 to 3 minute clip, just simply email us at editor@suspensemagazine.com with your clip and any information, and we will play that on the air in future shows coming up so you can go out and find more fans and let people know who you are as a writer and what your books are. So that's just something that we're doing for you to be able to get your book out there, to be able to have people listen to it. And it's free. I mean, it's free marketing, people. You can't be free. There's not a lot of places you can find free where it's good. So I want to welcome Elliot Patterson right now to the show to talk about his latest book, which is coming out in trade paperback. It was released in April of 2011, Ashes of the Earth. So, Elliot, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, John. Thanks very much for having me.
So, Ashes of Earth, the book came out last April, but now it's going to be released in trade paperback. It's your ninth novel. You said we were talking out there. You just finished your tenth. So tell us a little bit about Ashes of the Earth and maybe what you have coming up, because you also have a couple other series that you were writing, so we can get into all of that. So tell us a little bit about Ashes of the Earth.
Sure. Well, let me just mention as a segue into that, that my other, I have two other series, one set in Tibet and one set in colonial America, actually. But all of my books, including Ashes, and Ashes builds on these themes, are really about abandoned peoples. The backdrop is people that don't have formal justice available to them. Tibetans in modern day China, exiled Scots and American natives in my Bone Rattler series. And that sort of theme really has driven me for my entire writing career. And Ashes sort of takes that to the ultimate step, because it's set in a future post-apocalyptic world, and there's this the only human colony that we know of in this story is on one of the Great Lakes, and they're sort of the ultimate abandoned people. They've lost their entire world.
Wow. So, you know, with the Tibetan part, you know, that's something that is kind of just a mystery in people's minds, because it's such a it's one of those countries that people know about, but they don't really know about, if you have an idea. So was that something that you were able to go in and research and kind of really give, you know, that kind of, aspect to, you know, the book? Because it is one of those kind of very mysterious places.
Well, that's sort of it's a very deliberate goal of mine, you know, trying to bring readers into interesting, unusual, exotic venues, whether in, you know, Tibet, colonial America, or mm-hmm. a future. I was lucky enough in terms of the Tibet series, which is the Inspector Shan series, to have traveled that part of the world a lot. And have always been fascinated by Central Asia and Buddhism, so I had a lot of background already. But I constantly do research. So I'm every one of my Shan novels are written, seven of them now. I have separate themes, and I'm just continually doing research to support them, because I'm very, very fastidious about the factual underpinnings of all my books.
Yeah, and so you know. Ashes of Earth, just so people know, you know, it's a post-apocalyptic novel. So, you know, you're kind of taking an aspect that, actually in 2012, of course, is very prominent with the whole, you know, Mayans and everything else. People think that the world's going to end, and it was predicted 17,000 times by that one religious guy who now said, oh, I'm sorry, I got all that wrong. You know, was that something that, you know, I guess when you're going through your thought process and you're going through the building of the, you know, the book, was it more the character that kind of had that, or where you said, this is a book that I want to write, and then you can kind of put the characters in there? How was it? What was kind of first, the chicken or the egg?
The characters. My book's very character driven, character built. You know, I have a lot of intense characterization, and I want to I use these fairly intense backstories. You know, in post-apocalyptic backdrop is pretty intense. But these are characters that are like in my other books. They're faced with a terrible crime, a series of murders, and they have no real. There is essentially a government established in this colony, but it is a very tyrannical government, and they're not ready to call these crimes murders. And my protagonist, like in my other books, is an outcast, you know, from that society, trying to figure out, trying to resolve the crime. But at the same time, the backdrop, this post-apocalyptic world becomes a major plot driver, because it's sort of vestiges of the old world that are driving some of these crimes.
And, you know, since your books are very character-driven, do you find yourself, when you're writing a book like Ashes of the Earth, and, you know, you yourself are trying to write it one way, and your characters are kind of pulling you another way, like, no, you know, you kind of want to go into this aspect. You know, do you find those struggles, like, when you're writing that, you know, you as an author are struggling with your characters in general about, you know, trying to get the book done?
Yeah, when I start a book, I always know the opening scenes, and I know the closing scenes, and I know my characters, and from there on, it becomes a real journey with my characters, and they do help to build it, and after, for example, my Sean series, was having written seven of those, I know where my character is going to go in a given situation, and that sort of helps to build authenticity. In this post-apocalyptic book, Ashes, it developed in ways that I didn't really expect, and these characters became extremely compelling to me, and I began to realize what a terrible pathos all this is, of having to have your world ended and lost. Most of these characters lost all their families, in the destruction. But I should mention this is set 25 years later. So
right.
These are people that have been beaten down, and they're sort of scarred and callous, but they've survived, and that in itself there's been a certain selection around the type of characters who can survive, you know, for 25 years after the apocalypse, and they kind of have that behind them. I don't dwell on why the apocalypse happened, just that it did. And that leads you to a lot of questions about, well, you know, what would you and I do? Where would we be? There's something that develops, midway through this book, as I began creating sort of this anathema of talking about the old world. And I really believe a lot of survivors, as they build new families, they don't really want to talk. They feel guilty about their old world, and they don't want to talk about what happened. They want to sort of just move on, and they're happy to talk about, you know, for example, in literature, happy to talk about Shakespeare, but not happy to talk about some more modern writers from the 20th and 21st century, for example.
Now that you have, you have 9 books out, and you said, and the 10th one is finished, and it's going to be coming here soon. For people that have not read your writing and are just finding out about, who Elliot Patson is, and again, your website is elliotpatson.com, and that's ELIOTPATTISON. It's a fascinating website. People can find a lot of information, like you on Facebook. If someone's just coming up and saying, hey, I'm just finding out about you, what would be the one book that you would say, look, I want you to start with this one first before you kind of move on into, some of the other ones? Because this is the one that kind of captures the essence of, who I am as a writer, and this is what you're going to, this is the one I want you to start with.
Well, it would probably be The Skull Mantra, which was my first novel, and it won the Edgar Award for Best First Novel that year. And it really sets the stage for these sort of, abandoned characters that are central to all my books.
And That's the one here. Was a total standalone, or was that one of the? Is that one of your first books? That was in one of your series.
That was the first of the Inspector Shan series, which features a Chinese inspector who was sent to a gulag prison in Tibet because he sort of investigated people too high up in the party and was about to make allegations, and they preempted that by sending him off to this prison where half the inmates die, and they assumed they had buried him and they would never see him again. But for the Skull Mantra establishes how it starts out with him as a prisoner and establishes how by helping both the Tibetans and the local Chinese solve some very terrible crimes, he is released, but he's become a new person. He often says he's been reincarnated in Tibet, and he wants to stay in Tibet to help Tibet and solve these crimes because he knows the Chinese government will not do it for them. And so that is very much that theme, that character, of course, and those themes run throughout the Shan series, but they're also very much built into the my Early America series and the new Ashes book.
And, you know, now that you're looking back here, and this is something to do more along the lines of, you know, just you, not really as an author in your writing, but just the amount of years now that you've been doing this, and you've kind of seen how things have changed publishing-wise. I mean, of course, 10 books, you can have, you know, many years of doing this. Do you find that every time that you put something out that you have to do more, whether it's, you know, not just challenging yourself in your writing, but challenging and getting yourself more as an author to, you know, more fans, because there's just more competition that, you know, you guys have to go through with all these other ebooks and everything coming out? I mean, how do you find yourself every time a book comes out, whether it's promotion or whether it's whatnot, the challenges that you find yourself an author outside the writing of the book?
Right. I would say early in my writing career, I wasn't that actively involved in formulating the promotion, and the publishers were much more invested in it and mm-hmm. spent resources and dedicated people, and you see less and less of that. And I I'm lucky that I do have an established readership and an established reputation. I feel bad about a lot of new writers that have to jump into this milieu for the first time now, because it is such to get yourself established, you have to spend almost as much time, you know, promoting yourself and putting yourself out there as you do writing. And that doesn't always congeal with sort of the personalities of a lot of writers. So it's a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And even though, you know, you still won, you know, you won the Edgar Award for First Best Mystery, and, you know, you're also listed as a finalist for Best Author in the Dublin IMPAC Awards.
Which, by the way, was not a mystery award. That was a literary award. You know, so that was one of the few mysteries ever to be considered a finalist for that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and when you come out and, you know, you have all this adrenaline and you're feeling like, yes, you know, best mystery and best first mystery and I'm coming out of the gate and whatnot, do you find extra added pressure on yourself knowing that, hey, I've won this, now I have to go further to kind of show that, you know, I'm who I am, and you just keep pushing yourself? You know, do you find that pressure on you every book?
I think a writer who's really dedicated to his craft is always going to feel that pressure. You always want to be you always want your next book to be your best book. And, you know, people ask me what's my favorite book of all the ones I've done. It's always the one I'm working on now. You know,
always.
You need to be totally into it. And so, of course, there's pressure and the shifting. You know, the whole shifting foundations of publishing. You know, it just sort of intensifies that pressure. You know, publishers don't know. I mean, for example, a cornerstone of my readership is librarians, and that, yeah, the libraries buy an awful lot of my books, and push them very, very aggressively, and but now you have libraries going to ebooks, you know, and
right.
It changes the whole economic equation. Publishers who knew they could always sell, you know, a couple thousand, 2,000 or 3,000 to libraries, now, you know, the libraries want to buy ebooks, and the economics, you know, makes it much more difficult.
And I understand exactly, because, you know, the Kindle is now loaning books out, and now it's, you know, becoming just a huge. It's going to expand even further and further and further into those kinds of things. So, yeah, it makes it that much more difficult economic-wise, without a doubt.
Yeah, exactly.
And here's one kind of off the wall question. It's something that, you know, I always try to find some different questions for authors to where it's not the normal stuff that people can read about on their website. Because I'm going to tell you right now, if anyone's listening and you're new to the show, authors get their inspirations. They have no flipping clue where they get them. So don't ask the question. It just comes to them. If they knew that, they would be, you know, they'd be writing stuff every time. But here's one. What's the best compliment that you can receive from either a fan or maybe the press kind of literary review? What's the number one compliment that you can receive as an author?
Well, you know, I get there's different perspectives on that, but I, first of all, I get comments on a regular basis about how authentic my books are, so that people who have been, for example, seven books set in Tibet, people who have been heavily involved with the Tibetan cause for decades will send me comments about how, you know, reading your books, it does more for, you know, more for the cause than any number of the nonfiction accounts about what happened on Tibet. And in fact, I believe that your books put people more into Tibet than reading, you know, an autobiography of some lama from Tibet. You know, those sort of books. So there's sort of comments about the authenticity of my books mean a lot to me, the readers, but also there's the readers who say, not to be cliche, but I mean the reader who says, I can't put your book down, or I miss my train stop because I was reading your book. That's all. Those things are, you know, those sort of just honest, heartfelt comments always feel really good.
You know, and this is, you're probably one of the best people to ask this question, because I've never had an author on that wrote, you know, and got into Buddhism like this and was written and into this kind of area in Tibet and this kind of places in the world. Is, have you met the Dalai Lama or heard him speak?
I've heard him speak, and I don't want to sort of commercialize my contact.
Well, the reason why I asked this question, and I will say that we are scheduled, my wife and I are scheduled to hear the Dalai Lama speak in Long Beach. She's very involved, and I just wanted to know kind of, you know, what can I expect? You know, what can we expect from something like that? I mean, because I just find the man absolutely fascinating, and I find the whole thing fascinating, and I'd love to find out more research. So that's kind of why I asked that question.
Well, you know, I certainly would share your fascination. I mean, and it's not just because he's sort of this exotic wise man. It's also he stands for so much very, you know, so many very important, you know, aspects of culture and religion. It's also fascinating for somebody like me who's been following him for a long, long time to see how he's evolved as the pressure from China has evolved and gotten more aggressive. And my books, in fact, the one I have a Sean book coming out later this year, it's sort of a more raw rendition of Sean because of the situation in Tibet's gotten more raw. Just supporting the Dalai Lama, having a photograph of the Dalai Lama in Tibet can send you to jail.
Wow.
There are all these camps of, you know, internment camps for Tibetans caught with the photographs or for practicing Buddhism when they're supposed to be sort of worshiping communism, and, you know, almost in a literal sense. I mean, they're taking down all these Buddhist statues of Buddhas that have been there for centuries in some cases, and they're replacing them with statues of Chairman Mao. That's been going on for a long time, but they're doing that much more aggressively now. And they're saying things like the Communist Party is your Buddha. I mean, bizarre things, but they really mean it. You put that against the backdrop of these people like the Dalai Lama against that, you see what heroes they are. I mean, they're not just important in a spiritual sense, but they're very, very important in a cultural and a political sense as well.
And, you know, when you hear about those types of things and you go and you see them, is it easy to kind of, as an author, to incorporate those kinds of raw emotions from the people and things that they're going through to put them into your book and help kind of write the story itself? Because, you know, that's the kind of emotional things that people like to be able to understand, whether they, you know, feel sad or anger or happiness. I mean, that's kind of what you do as an author, is to get those emotions out of your fans.
Well, absolutely, and I do everything I can to make it as authentic as possible. And my stories always, the stories in Tibet always feature, you know, Westerners who are encountering Tibet for the first time and mm-hmm. sort of coming to grips with that. And it always triggers lots of different emotions. No question about that. You know, there's a lot of fear, a lot of fascination, a lot of spirituality. A lot of self-doubt on the part of Westerners who begin to question sort of their Western lifestyle when they compare it to what goes on in Tibet. You know, it's all kind of rich ground for a novelist.
Yeah, and those are kind of the underlying, like I said, the kind of the underlying emotions that you're able to draw out for your fans and onto yourself. You know, when you write a book, you know, like Ashes of the Earth or your Inspector Shan series, that makes you, I don't know if it's more fulfilling or just kind of, you're able to just kind of sit back, I think, as an author and, you know, and be able to kind of feel it from the fan's point of view, how that emotion is going to take place between not just your characters, but the interaction between your fans and what they're going to get out of it.
Right. And I have very sort of discrete sets of fans, people who are very much into my 18th century American books. Mm-hmm. A lot of those haven't read the Tibetan books, and a lot of the people that read the Tibetan books don't read the colonial American books. There's a bit of crossover, but it's kind of interesting to me. And then there's a whole different audience interested in these post-apocalyptic books that I've sort of tapped into, and that's been fascinating to me.
So moving forward, because you said you have your 10th book here and, you know, you have 7 in your Inspector Shan series and then you have a couple in your Bone Rattler series, what can your fans expect to see, you know, kind of as both of those series move on and progress with you in the future? What are they going to see from you?
Well, I've got the new Inspector Shan book coming out around Thanksgiving, and that, as I mentioned, that's going to be sort of it's mm-hmm. carries the same characters through, but in sort of a much more raw, edgy kind of backstory to that book. Then I have a third in the Bone Rattler series that'll be out next year. I'm committed as well to do another Shan after that, and I hope to have a sequel to the Ashes book after that. So I've got a fairly long horizon, and I'm just plugging away. I very much enjoy my characters and enjoy writing all of these different series.
Yeah, it sounds like that you've put yourself into a very busy time. I'm sure your publisher likes that, because there's nothing more than liking to see a writer write and getting your series and getting your stuff out there. So I'll tell you what, Elliot, I mean, I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been fascinating speaking with you. I love the area that your books are set, the topics that you have around them, the emotion that you bring, the realism with your characters. It's just all in a perfect kind of storm that you have here, with your whole library of work.
Oh, thanks very much. I enjoy these books, and I appreciate the interview, John.
Yeah. Well, thank you again, Elliot, for joining us. And, you know, we will speak with you soon, so keep us up to date on book 10. And we'd love to have you back on and talk a little bit more about that and see, how things are, progress going on with that one.
That would be great. I'll look forward to it.
All right. Enjoy yourself, Elliot, and have a good day.
All right. You too. Take care.
All right. So, again, everybody, that was author Elliot Patterson. E-L-I-O-T is how you spell his first name. Patterson.com is his website. We were talking about Ashes of the Earth, the book that's coming out here in paperback that was released back in April 2011, and he's got book 10 coming out. Check out his Inspector Shan series, his Bone Rattler series. Believe me, once you read one, you will definitely dive into the other, and before you know it, you've already read all 9 of his, and then you just can't wait for book 10 to come out, which he said is going to be another Inspector Shan book, so looking forward to that one. I want to again thank all of our guests that we had on, Catherine Arnold we had on first with The Resurrection of Hannah, and her book, her Samantha Clarke series, and her latest one coming out, The Fear of Things to Come, and her website, CatherineArnold.com. That's Catherine with R-Y-N-E. We also then had Spencer Sadal on, and Spencer was talking about his books, Dead of Winter and Lovesick. And you can check him out at SpencerSedal.com, S-E-I-D-E-L. And Elliot Patterson we just had on. And again, L.J. Sellers, The Sex Club, her book, we heard the audio thing on there. If you didn't listen to it, replay it, go back. It was right after the first, at the end of the first hour, or the end of the first half hour, actually. It was around 10:30. And then Libby Hallman, A Bitter Veil, her book comes out on April the 15th. Whew, okay. Well, I want to thank you guys all for joining us wherever you are, whenever you listen. Suspense Radio is not for us. It is for you. And I am your host, John Robb, and we will see you all next time. Check out suspensemagazine.com. Click on the Suspense Radio button to see who's coming up, because we have shows lined up, not next weekend, but the weekend after. Enjoy your day, everybody, and we will see you all in the future. Goodbye.